this is Neil Funk, and you're listening to Frank on the Chicago Bullseye.
Hello, this is Nick Friedel, and you're listening to Frank on the Chicago Bullseye. Hi, this is Chuck Swirsky, and you're listening to Fred on the Chicago Bullseye.
I'm Bob Love of the Chicago Bulls, and you listen to Freddie.
Hello again, everybody. Welcome to another exciting edition of the Chicago Bullseye. We have a very special show today. The great Sean Hyken on the line. Sean, how you doing, my friend?
I'm doing all right, Fred. Good to talk to you.
It's great to talk to you. You're one of the legendary figures in the Bulls podcasting world as a founding... You were a founding member of Locked On Bulls, correct?
Yeah, me and Cody.
Yeah, and you guys did a fantastic job on that show. And, God, every day I get down on my knees hoping that you'll be back on the scene covering the beloved very soon. So I'm doing my best to send the word out that you'll be back because KC, there's so many guys I love. Darnell Mayberry. But I would really love to have you, working back in Chicago covering the beloved Bull, because right now you're out, covering the NBA overall. Is that correct?
Yeah, in Portland. I'm with that Bleacher Report right now.
And they're not anywhere near as interesting as the beloved Bull are. So let's get the word out there. Well, I guess they are.
Who knows what the future is going to hold? But yeah, I love Chicago. I've always I would love to end up back there at some point. But I have no idea what is going to shake out.
Well, let's hit the ground running here with a little bit of talk about one coach, Jim Boylan. Jim Boylan, I tried to give him a chance. I was not a fan of what he did with Jabari Parker. I thought that was absolutely asinine, ridiculous, and that kind of thing will leave a bad reputation among the players throughout the league. But he did it. He got away with it, and the organization seemed to support him with it. This year rolls around. I've had enough. What he's done with Denzel Valentine, what he did with the timeout, not calling a timeout over a huge Laker run. I've just had it, and I'm fully off the Jim Boylan train. Why don't we get a little bit into your background with Jim? What do you think of Jim, and what do you think his reputation is across the league?
Well, I mean, I don't think his reputation as a head coach is great right now. And it seemed like there was a little bit of momentum towards, okay, maybe they should give him the benefit of the doubt after, obviously, so they fire Hoiberg like about a year ago, or a little less than a year, like December. And then that first week goes so disastrously. And then, they have the mutiny and the 4-hour practice. And then they, hey, he's like doing push-ups, and then like the Kings players are making fun of the Bulls, afterwards, in the tunnel after a game, like, oh, this is going to be another 3-hour practice. So that's the whole thing. But then, they had that stretch of 10 games in February after the Otto Porter trade, basically before everybody got hurt. And, I think that was enough to let people talk themselves into, hey, maybe he actually was onto something with his whole, you have to run, you have to crawl before you can walk. We want to, strip everything down and just focus on the fundamentals, and then we're going to, actually play kind of a more modern style that coming up. Nope. It seems like this is just kind of what the deal is, and I'm actually amazed that you're already totally at it, because I feel like when the Bulls have lost C-Red Fred, that's a pretty big indictment.
Well, they haven't lost me overall. I still believe the team
is
talented.
Bro, dude, I listen to your podcast with Mark on Bulls HQ. I know you tried to walk it back with those tweets where you're saying that you were gotten too emotional, but I think you let your true colors show there a little bit. I think Doggable Fred is coming out.
He caught me at a weak moment, I must admit, and I did let it fly.
I hate to see it.
This team is so darn frustrating, and I think you would concur. I mean, you were on board with what they did in the offseason. You felt they were definitely moving in the right direction, correct, over the summer with some of the additions they made?
Yeah, absolutely. You look at the moves that they made. I thought Thad Young was a good signing, a veteran who's just kind of a, his stats aren't flashy, but he's, kind of a, he's a winning player. He's won everywhere he's gone. He's a good veteran. He's kind of like, he kind of has the potential to be like the new Taj Gibson for that locker room, where he's just, a respected veteran who doesn't care about his own stats and just knows where to be all the time, and it plays hard on the defensive end, all that kind of stuff. Like, I thought that was a good signing. I thought Satoransky was a great signing because I thought he'd be a great complement to Zach LaVine, because he's a guy who doesn't need the ball and he's a decent defender to knock down a three. I thought the Kobe White pick was good at the time. All of this stuff, even like Luke Kornet, I kind of let myself get talked into Luke Kornet because I know you feel the way you feel about Luke Kornet, but at the time, I have, and like, I have friends who work for the Knicks or in, like, in their analytics department. They all kind of say, oh, you know, the advanced metrics all say that Luke Kornet is actually really impactful, and, you know, he's going to be a great, you know, third or fourth big, like, you can yeah, kind of let right. yourself get talked into it, but then you're just at a certain point. It's like, oh, no, this is still the Bulls.
Well, let's just start with that. I mean, like, Luke Kornet sucked. It's clear within three or four games he's not a good basketball player. He you know, and his one job is at wide open threes, which he failed miserably at. He's not good on the defensive end. The team was getting out-rebounded. When you out-rebounded in six of your first eight games as badly as the Bulls had been, and your action is to do nothing. Now, finally, Kornet's out of the rotation, but this is stuff that the average fan kind of figured out within like three or four games. You can't just keep on running into a wall and not making any changes whatsoever. And that's my frustration with Jim. I felt like, you know, we lose a game. We have a 19-point lead against the Lakers. We lose that one. 18 against the Knicks, 10 against the Cavs, and 10 against Charlotte. It's a razor-thin line between wins and losses. And when your coach doesn't do everything to put your team in position to win, it's frustrating. It really is, Sean. And I think he's hurt the team in at least three, you know, wins or losses. I don't want to act like he's the number one reason we're losing, because I think it's, you know, our key players playing poorly. But wouldn't you agree that coaching does matter somewhat? And, you know, what's the most important thing? Rotations and who's playing. And he's failed miserably in that, I think, so far this year.
Yeah, and then after the Lakers game when he didn't put the starters back in, and he said that it was like in his heart to, or he said like he wanted to develop the bench, and that's why he left them out there. It's like, dude, okay, that's something that they could have said last year and been fine, because when you went into last season, nobody thought that this team was, nobody except for John Paxson, I guess. I think they thought they were going to make the playoffs last year, but like nobody actually who watches the team thought that last year's Bulls team was going to be a playoff team. And so if they had said,
Well, no, before the season started, I honestly thought before all the injuries happened, I mean, they still won 21 games, and they were they had a massive amount of injuries. It was a Golden State level of injuries. It's not like the East was that great. Like, I didn't think they were that far behind Orlando or Detroit.
Okay, but people who aren't C Red Fred didn't think that they were going to make the playoffs last year.
You're right.
And so if last year they had said, you know what, we're going to just kind of, you know, we're blowing this lead, but we're going to leave the bench guys out there to develop. That's fine, because nobody was expecting them to make the playoffs. This year, they put on themselves in media day. First of all, with the moves that they made, they signed veteran players. You don't pay Thad Young and Tomas Satoransky what they paid them to say, oh, no, we're just in a rebuilding year. We're just trying to develop young talent. You sign those guys. Those are the kinds of players you sign when you're trying to actually be competitive right now. And then they said on media day, John Paxson said this on the record. Jim Boylan said this on the record. All the players said this on the record. We want to make the playoffs this year. They put the expectations on themselves that they are supposed to be a playoff team. And so that's the standard you have to hold them to. And so then when you then turn around as Jim Boylan, like eight games into the season or whatever, and say, oh, no, we were blowing this lead, but we just wanted to let the bench develop. No, like you can't do that. You can't have it both ways.
Don't you feel they were a playoff team before the?
I thought so before the regular season. I mean, I thought it was a possibility if everybody stayed healthy. I thought they could have been in the mix for that 6, 7, 8 seed in the East, because the East is still kind of weak.
The Nets lost tonight.
I mean, I think right. They still are. They aren't out of it. I think that says more about the East than it does about the Bulls, because none of those, like, I think if the season ended today, Cleveland would be in the playoffs.
Yeah.
And I mean, I have to give a lot of credit to John Beilein for the start they have. Like, I think that team is actually might be okay. But like, the Bulls team should be a lot better than they were and are. And I mean, I think that falls on a few different factors. I mean, the two guys that I think everybody thought were gonna take a huge leap this year were Zach LaVine and Lauri Markkanen. Now Zach LaVine was, you know, talking in the preseason about like, oh, I'm so tired of people saying stuff about my defense. And then, you know, the defense has been just as bad as it's always been his whole career. He's still taking the same bad shots that he's been taking his whole career. Markkanen, you know, you thought, you know, he had that incredible stretch in January and February last year after he was healthy, where he was putting up 20 and 10 every night for a couple of weeks. You thought, okay, this is the league where he's going to be doing that more consistently. He's just kind of hovering around the three-point line, and he's not being as aggressive as he should be. And so I think, you know, some of it falls on the player, but yeah, I think coaching is a big part of it. I think if you had a different coach, if you had a better coach, frankly, I mean, I like Jim personally. I think he's a good guy, but, you know, coaching matters. I mean, the early returns on Jim Boylan's first full season as a head coach are not great.
Yeah, absolutely true. Is do you what is the general reputation of Zach LaVine and Lauri Markkanen across the league? Do you feel they're viewed as, like, you know, really up and coming players, or do you feel like they're nice pieces, but they're not a one or two on a playoff team, any team that's going to be a contender? What was it before this season?
Well, I think there was a little bit more hope for these. I mean, I think at this point, Zach LaVine just kind of is what he is. You know, he's going to put up good numbers. He's going to put up a lot of points. But is his reputation now maybe more along the lines of, you know, what Devin Booker was before this year when the Suns have started winning? But, you know, we'll get to that in a minute. But, like, and up until this year, there was all, you know, the reputation of a guy like Devin Booker was, oh, well, you know, he puts up a lot of points, but he's not a winning player. He just kind of puts up empty stats on a bad team. That might just be what Zach LaVine is. Lowry is a little bit younger than Zach, and I think there's still a little bit more upside, but I don't know. I think I want to see him be more aggressive on the glass. I want to see him be more aggressive attacking the basket. You know, he can knock down threes, but I wonder if he's maybe going to be, if at this point he's kind of like Nico Mirotic in the sense that, like, you know, he has this reputation of, oh, he's a great 3-point shooter, but the shooting numbers don't really back that up at this point.
Agree 100%. Yeah, and I expect him to take a jump this year. He just missed far too many wide open 3-pointers, and, you know, it's still early. I that's the only thing I feel a little bit embarrassed about is, you know, really turning on the team. You know, we're 10 games, 11 games in. Come on, you know, it's a little bit early to bury him, but, you know, still.
But at a certain point, that's like 12 or 15% of the season.
Yes.
It's not like this is happening after two games. We're you know, more than 10% of the way into the season. We're almost a month into the year. Like, at a certain point, like, you have, like, stuff is going to add up to, okay, maybe this actually is telling us something.
Well, which is so frustrating to me, Sean, is I think the Bulls, all these games that they played against these hack teams, like, I think they've been better than every team outside of the Lakers in Toronto. I felt like, you know what, the Bulls roster is better than what Charlotte has, what Cleveland has, what the Knicks have. You know, and they lost all these games. It's just so frustrating. It's really kind of hard to describe from my perspective as someone who was so confident they were moving in the right direction to start out this way. It just leaves you feeling helpless, and you've kind of lost your base and who you are. I feel lost and adrift.
And on paper, I think the Bulls do have more talent on their roster if everybody is healthy and everybody is what they thought they were. I think the fact that LaVine and Markkanen haven't made the leaps that we maybe thought they would, and, you know, Otto hasn't been healthy for some of this time. Who knows when he's going to be back? You can't really, you know, in the grand scheme of things, you know, most teams deal with injuries. You can't really, you know, just, you know, point to that as, like, the whole reason. But, like, the Bulls should be better than they are in terms of, you know, the amount of talent that they have. I don't know. I mean, I think some of it maybe is just, you know, some of these players aren't as good as we thought they were. Some of it's coaching. I don't know. I don't think there's one source to blame it all of it on.
So Coby White wins the game tonight, you know, with another incredible performance, you know, after he basically won the Memphis game. So he's won, you know, two of our four wins. He's basically won almost by himself. But, you know, the previous five games he was shooting below 25% from the field, 11% from three, 64% from the line. He was terrible over five games. Yet, you know, a guy like Denzel Valentine, who I stand by as a fantastic three-point shooter, a very good rebounder for his position, the team was starving for both of those skills. And he had a poor preseason, probably rightly so, coming back from serious rehab stint. And he's buried. He's buried on this roster. What's your take on Denzel Valentine from your background of watching him? And do you feel that he's a rotation player in the future, or am I wrong?
You're never going to come off the Denzel Valentine thing.
I just want to throw it out there.
Like, really, we're gonna be like 4 years from now, Denzel's going to be like, I don't know where he's going to be. He's going to be either be in, like, China or, like, some minimum team. And you're going to be like, hey, you know what? Really shouldn't have let Denzel. Like, I can just totally see that happening. You know what? I think the injuries were part of it with Denzel, but, I mean, there were health-related red flags on him coming out of the draft. Like, he had problems with his knees when he was in college at Michigan State, and then he had ankle problems. I don't know. I mean, you always want to give guys the benefit of the doubt that, you know, they can get better, but I don't know. I mean, I'll say this. Maybe Denzel just needs a shot, and he's going to finally, you know, put it all together, but I don't have any real, actual, concrete evidence to point to say, you know what, Denzel Valentine definitely is better than he has shown.
Well, what's inexcusable is in the Houston game, that they're down by over 20 points with 3.5 minutes left. And the night before he scored, you know, had a fantastic performance for Windy City. He doesn't even get in the game. This clown has Thad Young out there playing the last 3.5 minutes in a 20-plus loss, risking him to injury, you know, pulling a Tibbs. It's inexcusable. It's inexcusable to put a player in that situation, and I was shocked, you know, more wasn't made out of it. I do want to get your opinion on that. What do you feel about players that are valuable, rotation players, playing in the closing seconds of a blowout or closing minutes? You saw that a ton with Tibbs. Did that not irritate you?
I still remember the Game 6 of the Milwaukee series in 2015, which was Tom.
So do I. I know exactly what you're talking about.
Like, it was like they won by like I forget the exact.
They were up by 40 plus.
Yeah, they were up by something ridiculous like that, and Joakim Noah was still out there.
I know.
And this was after that. This was after like Tom had spent the whole year fighting with management about Joe. Joe having this minutes limit that he had to hold him to. Maybe Tom just kind of knew that he was going to get fired no matter what, and so he just kind of stopped caring at that point. The other one that I remember is he playing Jimmy Butler all 48 minutes in a preseason game. That was my favorite. I think
wait a second. I don't remember that. That actually happened.
It was against Orlando.
Oh my gosh! I don't remember that.
He played Jimmy Butler all 48 minutes in a. Basically, Jimmy Butler spent his whole rookie year basically like upset that he wasn't getting any playing time, and then Tom was like, "Hey, you want some playing time? Here, just play all 48 minutes of this preseason." Like, I mean, that's. I mean, for better or worse, that's Tom.
Yeah, definitely for worse. I know exactly what you're talking about. That was Game 6. That was a game where Giannis threw Mike Dunleavy into the second row in that playoff game.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I remember just sitting there and saying at that moment Thibodeau was dead to me, because you had Noah, who clearly was a guy who wasn't healthy even at that point. He was kind of running around like, right, you know, like the Tin Man from Wizard of Oz. And he's got him in there, and they're up by 40 plus in the fourth quarter. And I'm just like, this guy, it's just ridiculous. It's, you know, he did that too all his career. I remember him doing that to Carlos Boozer after he came back from an injury when the Bulls were blowing out Philly very early. Like, it was like within his first 3 weeks as a head coach, and nobody really said anything about it then. But I remember thinking, like, why the heck would Carlos Boozer, who remember, if you recall, when they signed him, he was injured. He fell over a bag or something. He missed the first.
Yeah, he broke his hand. I remember that.
Yeah, exactly. So the guy had an injury kind of history before then, and oh, he's playing them, and they're up 25 plus, and he's playing in the fourth quarter.
Kind of before the book was really out on Tibbs, though, because that was his first head coaching job, and he had been an assistant for Doc in Boston before that, and he was just like seen as like this hard nosed defensive guy. But nobody, it's kind of like now, you know, with Boylan, like Boylan now has been, you know, for he's been in the league for 20 or 25 years or whatever, and you know, he's been with all these great organizations like the Rockets and the Spurs, and he was hired from San Antonio, where he was on Greg Popovich's staff, so he has this great pedigree. And then people, you know, when he takes over as head coach, when they fire Hoiberg, people think, oh, you know, he, you know, maybe he'll, it'll be like a, you know, the Pacers elevated Frank Vogel, and he was kind of a harder nosed guy than Jim O'Brien, and then ended up being really successful. That was the optimistic view. And then, like, within a week of Boylan taking the job, it's like, oh, okay, this is actually what this is going to be. We're going to be doing 3-hour practices and having guys run suicides and do push-ups after practice. Like, that's what this is going to be.
In your years covering the team then, was there any players that you had, maybe even off the record, who told you, this is ridiculous? Like, I know Rip Hamilton had that viewpoint about it, but were there any players that kind of shared with you their frustration over those type of practice habits?
Guys were, I mean, I was off the beat by the time Jim took over as head coach, but I can tell you, most guys were pretty much done with teams by the end of his time there. Like, whether it was Noah or, I mean, I think the two guys that were, that's like, because during exit interviews, I mean, that last Tibbs year, management had already, like, decided they were going to fire Tibbs. Like, the relationship was too far gone, but they still asked all the players in exit interviews whether they wanted him back. The only two guys on the team that fought for him were Rose and Taj. And Taj, because Taj is a company man, and Taj is never going to say anything bad about a coach, because Taj was a big Tibbs defender, and Taj was also a big Hoiberg defender the next couple of years. And then Rose just always, you know the relationship that Rose and Tibbs had, because Tibbs always had his back when he was coming back from the injuries, and people were saying, why isn't he playing? And Tom was always the one saying, Derek is going to decide when he feels ready to play. So Derek kind of had his back, but Joe was done with him. Jimmy was done with him. And I think both of them later on kind of realized what they had once both of them didn't really click with Hoiberg. But a lot of guys were just kind of done with Tom by the end.
That's so interesting. So Butler was one of them. Because that's
that was just kind of by the end. But that whole year was so weird because they probably should have broken that group up by then anyway. It's one of those things where you leave the group together 1 year too long, and guys were all kind of tired of each other by that point anyway. Those last couple of Rose, Noah, Gasol years, that was so toxic.
Yeah,
but that whole locker room.
They won 50 games that year. I agree with you.
They had a lot of talent, but it was the mix of people. They were all just kind of tired of each other by that point. And then, all the stuff between Tibbs and management was just kind of, everybody knew there was something off about that relationship at that point. It was that was a mess.
It was a mess, but we always got to go back there anytime you're on, so I apologize about that. I always love to hear those stories about that era because it is so utterly fascinating that team never won a title. But, you basically go three straight years without your MVP playing in playoff games from 2012, 13, and 14. It's going to happen. Since you brought it up, though, I do want to bring out one thing, since it's kind of been talked about recently. Were you around the team, or did you ever talk to anyone about Derek in that subsequent year after he tore his ACL? And were you around the team that year?
I wasn't around for the ACL year. My first year was the year after the ACL when he tore his meniscus 10 games into the season.
So everybody was waiting for him to come back. Is that right? That was where you were there.
Which year? No. I was the year where there was the why isn't he coming back? That was no. They actually handled it the right way. The year I was there, because my first year was the meniscus year. When he had the surgery, they put out a press release saying that he's ruled out for the season, and then they just never came up again. And that was that was the right way to handle it. That was the way they should have handled it beforehand. They shouldn't have said, he's cleared to play. We don't know when he's going to come back. They should have said from the start, he's not going to play. They should have done I realize it's a different injury because Achilles is a lot more severe, but the Nets this year, they signed Kevin Durant. They came out over the summer and said, we're operating as if Kevin Durant is not going to play this year. So that's what they should have done. That's what they should have done with Rose the whole time.
Yeah, well, I do think though, so you're saying when, so he obviously gets hurt April of 2012. And so he misses the whole next year. I do feel that most people kind of at that time somebody else got hurt. It was Iman Shumpert got hurt on the exact same day.
Yeah.
The exact same injury.
I remember that, yeah.
And Iman Shumpert came back. And this is something people don't talk about enough because people kind of relive in history from that era recently.
Also because Iman Shumpert isn't Derrick Rose.
Yeah, he's definitely not Derrick Rose.
No franchise's hopes are resting on whether Iman Shumpert is. I mean, he was a fine role player at one point, but no franchise is hanging their entire future on whether Iman Shumpert is coming back from a torn ACL the way that the Bulls were with Derrick Rose.
No doubt. But Iman was a very, athletic player, very simple, not as obviously as athletic as Derrick, but he was known for his athleticism. He tore his ACL on the exact same day, and he came back in January. The following January. So I remember that was kind of like a narrative. Well, this Iman Shumpert heard it on the exact same day Derek did. He came back in January. So February, March, April. And the Bulls are better than people expected. The Bulls actually win a playoff series that year against the Nets. A fantastic series, if you recall. And then they lose to Miami in the second round. I didn't feel like it was out of the realm of possibility for anyone. I think most people expected him to come back. I don't think it was I think it was a little bit surprising he didn't come back. Do you feel that was, do you recall, take yourself back to that time period. Did you feel the same way that were you surprised he did not come back? I'm not saying it was right or wrong. I'm just saying
I was a little bit, But also that was back before. You have to keep in mind that was pre. Like Derrick Rose is almost like at the forefront of the whole load management thing, and like all anybody talks about now. Like that's been the conversation the whole last basically year in the NBA is load management, because you know Kawhi Leonard is sitting out back to backs, and certain guys are just kind of you know choosing games where they're gonna sit out. Derrick Rose got crushed for that, and now everybody's basically saying, "Oh, this is the smart thing to do." But I think people people didn't know that at the time. That wasn't really the prevailing thought at the time. And like around the same time, I think this the same season, that 12-13 season, that was the season where Kobe tore his Achilles and then, you know, hit two free throws on his Achilles. And so that was kind of still the mentality for a lot of fans was, oh, well, Kobe's tough and Kobe is, you know, a true competitor. Yeah. And Derrick Rose is soft because he doesn't feel 100%. So he's not going to play off of this serious knee injury. Like, I mean, the thing is, since then, like, teams have started becoming a lot more cautious. Like, Kristaps Porzingis tore his ACL in February of 2018. He didn't play at all last season. And now, you know, he's looking kind of rusty coming back. Zach missed about a year. I mean, honestly, if Zach had not played at all that first season when he was traded to the Bulls, I don't think anybody would have really blamed him. He did end up coming back, but, you know, it took him basically that season to... Yeah. Get back in. Like, Klay Thompson tore his ACL in the finals. I would be shocked if Klay plays at all this season.
Yeah, and then, but then you hear he's trying to come back. It's different for every player.
Well, of course, Klay's trying to come back, but the medicals, especially since now there's that perception out there, whether it's fair or not, is a different discussion, but there's this perception out there now about the Warriors that they let Durant come back too early in the finals, and then that's why he tore his Achilles. So now, like, there's no, even if Klay says, I feel 100%, I want to play, I'll bet the Warriors don't even let him play.
Well, see, I think the load management kind of came in before that, you know, when you look when Derek tore his ACL, I remember I went back, I did a deep dive on this. He had injury after injury. That first of all, that was a strike shortened season. So all the games were like on top of each other. January. I remember reading his article. He's in a walking boot, and like two games later, he's playing like 40 minutes. It's like it was an absolute joke, you know. And if people would be shocked if you looked at some of the minutes he was playing after injuries or coming back from injuries, you know, against garbage teams, the Bulls. Well, Tibbs, you know, he handled it like it was 1950. You know, that's how people, you know, put some mud on it, dirt on it, and play. That's how it was handled, and it was wrong. And so I think, you know, the Bulls, that was the heart of what the issue was between management and Tibbs, wasn't it? The Bulls put a minutes limit on Rose and Noah, and he didn't like it. And he complained to his buddy, and it got national news. And isn't that the heart of what happened?
Well, I think part of it, I think there were... You know, I think there was fault on both. I mean, not to just relitigate the whole Tibbs thing because we've done that a million times.
Yeah, but it's still fun.
But like, I mean, there was definitely fault on both sides in that relationship. I definitely think that, you know, management did a lot of, you know, leaking stuff to certain media outlets about, you know, how unhappy they were with Tibbs and basically trying to start this, you know, create this narrative that he's just totally unreasonable. But then Tom also did some stuff. There's just one game I remember that last season. A game that they had, we were in Oklahoma City, and they lost that game, and Joe didn't play at all in the fourth quarter. And we asked Tom after the game why Joe didn't play, and he's like, "Well, I ran out of minutes in my minutes limits." Like he would like do stuff like that, just sort of to make a point and to just kind of thumb his nose. So like, I think that some of the stuff they were trying to get him to do, and then some of the things they were leaking about him were unreasonable. But also, I don't think he handled it great on his end either. So that's my take on the Tibbs thing. And I think there was plenty of blame to go around on both sides.
No doubt. Let's get to some bigger issues as the NBA as a whole, as you're covering them.
Sure.
But before we get into that, one last question: do you feel this Bulls team? You know, they're 4-7 now. They're still on the edge of the playoffs. There's a lot of bad teams in the East. Do you think they're still going to make the playoffs, or do you think? No, this is headed for another lottery.
I'm not going to sit here and completely rule them out because the East is so bad once you get past like Philly, Milwaukee, Toronto, Boston. Like I think they, you know, somebody's got to get those last few spots. And so maybe it's the Bulls, but the Bulls have definitely, even in these games they've won, like they have not shown enough for me to say, oh, I definitely feel good about them. They're going to be fine.
Yeah, so
if you made me guess right now whether they make the playoffs, yes or no, I would say no.
So let's just, I'm going to throw out a few teams that you think will make it ahead of them. You know, the Nets, 4-6 right now. You think the Nets obviously probably are better. Would you?
I don't love the Nets, but I would say just because of the coaching advantage and some of their depth guy. Yeah.
Hornets.
No.
Cavs.
Cavs are kind of interesting to me. So I don't know.
Yeah, the Hawks. I think the Bulls are
Hawks.
Better.
I like the Hawks more than the Bulls.
Oh my gosh. Pistons.
Your boy DeAndre Hunter, by the way, is looking good.
I love DeAndre Hunter, and I will stand by that.
I like a lot of guys. The Hawks were actually just here in Portland on Sunday, so I got to see them up close. Like, I like him. I like Trae Young. Obviously, Trae's incredible. I like Kevin Huerter a lot. Once they get John Collins back from this PED suspension, that team's got some pieces. And I also really like their coach, Lloyd Pierce. I think he's a really good coach.
I agree. Although Trae Young's defense is, oh my gosh, that was some of the worst defense
I've ever seen on
Satoransky. You know. Yeah, but you take.
He gives you so much offensively. He just destroyed the Nuggets tonight. I don't know if you saw any of that game.
I did not, but I didn't. Wait, they beat the Nuggets? You got to be kidding me.
Yeah.
How did I miss this?
Yeah, Trae just went off. He had like 35 the other night when they were here in Portland.
So let's go a little bit now, since you're covering the NBA as a whole. Right. What has been your team that you've seen so far this year they're a lot better than I expected? Your biggest surprise on the positive and your biggest surprise on the negative?
Well, and this is going to be kind of a cliche answer at this point, but this is kind of, everybody's talking about it. But Phoenix, you have to really say, okay, I mean, I thought Phoenix wasn't going to be good at all. And I mean, maybe I was underestimating, the impact that Ricky Rubio can still have. Maybe I was definitely underestimating the Aaron Baines acquisition, because he's been great for them. The fact that, DeAndre Ayton, last year's number one overall pick, gets suspended for 25 games for PED stuff. He and they're still kind of in the spot. You have to give Monty a lot of credit. I think Monty Williams is probably a coach of the year front runner at this point. But Phoenix is really interesting. They're kind of this year's Sacramento, where, like, remember last year's Sacramento team? And nobody came into the season expecting them to be good, and then they didn't make the playoffs, but they were kind of in it until the last couple weeks of the season before they kind of fell back. Phoenix is in that zone where, especially with, a team like Portland, maybe I'll get to them as my biggest disappointment, but Phoenix, if you told me today, based on everything we've seen this season, if you told me, Phoenix hung around, they made the playoffs as the 7 or 8 seed, it wouldn't shock me.
See, I would be shocked.
So I think you have to give Monty Williams a lot of credit, and, Ricky Rubio's been good, Devin Booker, I think, for a guy who, I think I talked about him a little bit earlier as like a Zach LaVine comparison for what the reputation of just being kind of this empty stats guy who just puts up a lot of points but doesn't contribute to winning. I think a lot of Devin Booker's he's been putting a lot more effort in on the defensive end. His playmaking has gotten a lot better. He's been taking some smarter shots. Like, I like a lot of what we've seen out of Devin Booker so far. Now, as far as a negative surprise, I'm going to kind of stay home and say Portland. Like, that's a team, they make the Western Conference Finals last year. They obviously shake a lot of things up. They let a lot of their role players like Al-Farouq Aminu and Mo Harkless go. But, you still have Damian Lillard. You still have C.J. McCollum. They were really high on the Hassan Whiteside acquisition. There were kind of some other guys they brought in who, they thought, we're just going to switch some things up and we're going to still be right here in the mix in the Western Conference, and Damian Lillard is an MVP candidate and all this. And everything has just kind of fallen apart. The Zach Collins injury has killed them, because now you're trotting out like Mario Hezonja and Anthony Tolliver as your front court rotation, like Scalabissier. Like Nasir Little is playing significant minutes for them now, and they plan for him to not play at all this year. And so things really just could not be going worse for Portland right now. And as we watch this, there's 38 seconds left in this game. They're playing in Sacramento. They are down 106-97.
So what Whiteside is just not – what's going on with him? I was not a fan of that move. I think it was – wasn't that a financial move at its heart to help alleviate some cap concerns?
Yes and no. Yes and no. Neil Olshey, the Blazers' general manager, has been a fan of Hassan Whiteside for a long time. He tried to sign him in 2016 when he signed that big contract with Miami, and then Hassan ended up staying in Miami. But the thing about Neil Olshey is he has guys that he likes.
Mm-hmm.
And then he just will never come off of that. Even if the guy has a few years where he's not very good, if he liked a guy a few years ago when he's a free agent, he's never going to come off of it. Like, that's the thing. And I mean, Whiteside is almost a big man version of what I was just saying about Zach LaVine. Like, if you just look at Hassan Whiteside's numbers on Basketball Reference, you can say, oh, he averaged 20 points and 15 rebounds a game. Like this guy should be an All Star. But he's a guy who chases his own stats for the most part. He doesn't really contribute. Like he averages a lot of blocks, and so people think that because he averages a lot of blocks, he's a good defensive player, but he really is out of position all the time, and he just kind of tries to chase blocks to chase stats. It's almost like how Russell Westbrook chases rebounds or chases assists, and it's maybe not the most, you know, winning conducive play. That's kind of what Hassan Whiteside is, and I think the idea when they brought him in was, yes, he has this reputation that he has in Miami, but the Blazers' culture is so strong, and Damian Lillard is such a good leader, and you saw what he did with Nurkic when they brought him in, and he didn't have a great reputation in Denver. But I don't know. I think this is just kind of the player that Whiteside is. He's talented. He puts up good numbers, but I don't know if he's really, you know, the kind of guy that can be, you know, contribute to, you know, winning in that really significant way. I don't know.
Is Nurkic expected back this season?
That is a good question. They have very intentionally been not letting a lot of information get out there. They don't want to put on expectations and say, oh, he's going to be back in January, he's going to be back in February, because then, like, if he is, then it's setting expectations too high. So they've very purposely been saying, we're happy with his progress, but we'll let you know when we know something. What I've heard is that they kind of are hopeful that he'll be back by the All-Star break. But, I mean, the thing about Nurk is he had this, like, Gordon Hayward missed a full year with that injury. Paul George missed basically a full year with that broken leg. The difference between those two guys, I mean, those guys came back, I think, sooner if you look at months than Nurk maybe will have. The thing about those guys is those two guys don't weigh 290 pounds like Nurkic does. So even once he's cleared to play, like once he's 100% cleared for basketball activities, that doesn't mean they're going to throw him out on the court the next day. He will have not done anything in months, and he's going to have to get his conditioning back up. He's going to have to get get back in shape that way. Like, it's going to take some time. If you told me that he came back in February, I would not be surprised. But if you told me that he didn't play at all this year, I also wouldn't be surprised. But I honestly don't know. Like I said, they have been very deliberately trying to not let a lot of information about him get out there. Everything they've said was that they're happy with his progress and they think that his rehab is going well. But they have not. They've made the choice to not put a date on it.
So the Blazers right now are 4-6 on the outside looking in.
Now to be 4-7.
They're 4-7. I would the exact same record as the Bulls.
They've got Toronto tomorrow. The difference between the Bulls and the Blazers is the Blazers have Damian Lillard.
Yes, you gotta
definitely. Damian Lillard can cover for a lot. Like they would their record, like those four wins, they would not Dame has just been on another level this year. The problem is like what anybody. I mean, CJ McCollum has been better the last couple of games, but he started off the year in a pretty big slump. Kent Bazemore hasn't been hit. But, like other than Dame, and, you know, Anthony Simons, their guard that they drafted last year, he didn't really play last year, but he's looked pretty good so far this year. But other than Dame, like, there really isn't too much out there right now for the Blazers.
No, agreed. Do you think, though, you know, the Mavs are 6 right now, Suns 7, Timberwolves 8. Do you think they're going to get into one of those final playoff spots based on what you've seen so far this season, or are they going to be in a lottery team for the first time in forever?
Portland?
Yeah.
I think they have another move to make. I don't know what that will be. The thought, like the common like fan thing here is, oh, they should trade for Kevin Love because Kevin Love is from the Portland area and he kind of has that connection. I don't think that the Kevin Love thing is going to happen because even if the Cavs do make him available, I think they would get better offers than like Hassan Whiteside and a protected first or whatever that Blazers would be able to offer. I don't think that Portland would really have enough to make that deal happen. Danilo Gallinari is a guy that I think makes a lot of sense. I think he would be a good fit on this roster, and I think he's definitely gettable because he's an expiring contract. Literally, if you give Sam Presti the protected first rounder for anything, he'll say yes. So yeah. I think he's a guy that would be interesting to go after. I don't know if Orlando, like, they haven't looked great to start the year off. Maybe they decide they want to move Aaron Gordon. It'll probably take a little bit more to get him. I don't know. But I don't know who it's going to be. They definitely have another move to make in some capacity, though.
Yeah, if the Bulls keep on going south, Thad Young might be available.
Larry Markkanen?
Larry Markkanen? Oh, my. What about Ed? Well, Ed Davis is on Utah now. He's a guy I loved when he was up there.
Ed Davis is one of my favorite guys I've ever covered in terms of, like, as a reporter working in a locker room. He's just the best guy.
Yeah, he's great you see his departure from the Nets has had a negative impact. But
he kind of had like a Taj Gibson effect, like the way that people in Chicago feel about Taj, that's the way people in Portland feel about Ed Davis. I know Dame was really unhappy when they didn't re-sign him.
Yeah, I love the guy too. I was hoping the Bulls go after him, but He's doing great in Utah. So the Lakers and Clippers to me are the two best teams in the West. I don't know if you feel the same, and they're on a collision course. When that happens, who do you feel is going to come out ascendant?
Are we assuming everybody's fully healthy?
Yep. Yeah, Paul George will be back soon.
Oh, well, then then the Clippers for sure. Like I just think the Clippers. From what I've heard, I think Chris Haynes reported today that Paul George is going to come back this. I'm one of these. They have this upcoming road trip. I think like New Orleans and Houston. They said that Paul George is going to play somewhere on that road trip. So we're going to see them at full strength soon. But if you just look up and down the roster, obviously both teams have these incredible superstar duos. But I just like so many more of the Clippers guys. Like whether it's Lou Williams, you see what he can do off the bench, Montrezl Harrell, Patrick Beverley. They just have so many more guys that I look at than the Lakers do, because obviously LeBron and Anthony Davis are incredible, and especially the LeBron that we've seen this year, like he's just been so locked in and so engaged in a way that he wasn't last year. Like he seemed like he was kind of checked out last year, but now I think he's kind of on a mission. You saw him like yell out like he's like the Wash King or something. I think he's really motivated to prove to people that he isn't washed up in year 17. But once you get past the top few guys on the Lakers, Danny Green is a terrific addition for them, a great role player, a 3-and-D guy. Like it's the perfect kind of complimentary guy to put next to those two. But once you get past that, it gets shaky pretty quickly. You're looking at like Rajon Rondo, who's supposed to make his debut soon, and then like.
Yeah.
Did he play tonight? Did he play tonight against Phoenix? I didn't see any of that game, but he's been like working his way back.
Anyone?
And then, like you've got like Kentavious Caldwell Pope is in there, and like their rotation, like the drop off. Obviously, as long as LeBron and Anthony Davis are healthy, they're going to be fine. But the rotation it gets a little shaky pretty quickly once you get past those top few guys. Whereas the Clippers, I feel a lot better about their depth. We know Doc Rivers is one of the best coaches in the league. He always gets a lot out of guys. If you made me pick who's going to fully healthy, who's going to win via seven-game series between the Clippers and the Lakers, I'm taking the Clippers.
So you have them coming out of the West.
If they're fully healthy, but again, Paul George had surgery on both shoulders this offseason.
Yeah,
he's just
true.
About to come back now, so you can't say, oh, well, he just had these major procedures, and now we just are going to say, oh, he's 100% going to be healthy in the playoffs. Like, so much of it comes down to a lot of that stuff. It's so hard. I think my hottest take about this season right now, and I said this before the season, and I'm feeling pretty good about that right now. I said, like, during the preseason, I think Toronto can still win the East, even though they lost Kawhi Leonard.
Wow. So is that who you have coming out of the East? Like, right now, if you had to put money on it, who would you bet comes out of the East?
I guess Milwaukee, if you made me put money on it, because Giannis is still incredible, and he looks like he's even made another leap this year from where he was last year, but, like, the Middleton injury hurts them. With Toronto, it's just, like, their player development and their depth is just so crazy. Like they lose Kawhi Leonard, they lose the finals MVP, who was, like, arguably the best player in the world during the playoffs, and maybe the best player in the league still right now. They lose him.
Agreed.
Pascal Siakam is just sliding right into that Kawhi role, and then OG Anunoby, who basically didn't play in the playoffs last year because he was not healthy, is sliding right into what the Siakam role was last year. And then Fred VanVleet is still good. Like, they have other role players, and they're so well coached. Like, I like Toronto.
It's amazing. Wow, wouldn't that be something if Toronto ended up playing the Clippers in a final?
How great would that be? I think as far as like storyline, from like a storyline standpoint, I think that would be as far up there as anything, except for maybe like I don't know who in the East you would want the Cavs. LeBron versus, I mean, the thing is there's no players. Like, if Kyrie was still on the Celtics, then like a Lakers-Celtic finals would be kind of interesting from that standpoint. But like Yeah, Clippers Raptors would be a lot of fun, just from a narrative standpoint, and from like, can the Raptors, can Kawhi Leonard be the Finals MVP on his third different team in his career, or can the Raptors win a championship after losing the Finals MVP? Like that would just be so intriguing.
Sean, you're the best. You've given us over 40 minutes. One last question to wrap this up. Do you have an MVP vote, first of all?
I don't.
If you did, who would you give it to so far for this young season?
I guess Giannis. I don't know. It's we're like 10 games into the season. It's way too early to really do that. But I guess, Giannis is probably my pick at this point. Kawhi is going to Giannis or LeBron, I think, would be my two.
Yeah, I think choices. I think LeBron needs serious consideration if he's going to play.
He does. I mean, if he keeps playing like this and the Lakers finish
with the
1 or 2 seed in the West, I mean, yeah, like you kind of have to. I think like the longest gap between somebody's first MVP and their last MVP was Kareem, like 9 years.
Yeah. Oh, I didn't know.
I think both Kareem and Jordan went 9 years between their first MVP and their last MVP. And so, you know, LeBron won his first one in 2009. So if he wins one in 2020, then that's 11 years, which is pretty incredible.
It is. It is. I mean, you
hold up Kareem as like the all-time. He played 20 years and he was still great at the end. So you hold him up as like the all-time like longevity. If LeBron wins MVP at age 35. After, you know, in year 17, that would be pretty unprecedented.
Yeah, watching him in that Dallas game was, I just hit me. I mean, this guy's still playing at an insane level.
He's locked in. And I mean, the thing that people have to remember is, until last year, he made the finals 8 years in a row, 4 times in Cleveland, 4 times in Miami. He played in a couple of Olympics in that time. He basically had no time off that whole for 8 years, he basically was just going full throttle that whole time. Last year, the Lakers didn't make the playoffs, so then he basically has until from April until October when camp starts, where he's just kind of resetting and recalibrating, and now he's back and he's locked in, and we're seeing what the results are so far, and it's pretty scary.
It's pretty amazing. Pretty amazing stuff. Sean, thanks again for coming on to Bullseye. Where can people find you on Twitter and in print or online?
On Twitter and on Instagram, at Hikin, H-I-G-H-K-I-N. That's just my last name. That's my Twitter handle. Writing stuff on Bleacher Report. I've got a couple things coming out next week. I've got some cool stuff in the works for down the line that I think I'm pretty excited about, but I don't know if I should say too much about that right now. But that's some cool stuff in the works. That's all I'm really going to say. But, yeah, I mean, read me on Bleacher Report. Whenever I have something written, I'll tweet it out. Just follow me on Twitter at Hikin. That's probably the easiest way to do it. But always good to talk to you, my man.
It is. It is. And I cannot wait for that moment when we're all at Grand Park for title number 7.
How are you feeling about the prophecy? Are you still on the 7 seed in 2020, or are we more looking at a 4th straight 7th pick? Like, are you going to have to update the prophecy?
Well, I think the 7th seed, believe it or not, is still looking pretty good. We're only like a game or two out of it, but the 7th title, even I will admit, doesn't look very promising right now.
You're going to take the L on that one?
I hope not. I'm still going to try to hold on hope, and I'm going to wait until at least the All-Star break to make a correction on it. But it's not looking good. I got to be honest. Can you imagine Boylan hoisting the O'Brien Trophy?
NBA championship coach Jim Boylan. So this is my thing about and this is kind of almost circling back to, you know, we were just talking about Phoenix as this great surprise team. If this Bulls team had Monty Williams as their coach, I think they would definitely be
least. I know. They'd be 7-4. I even said if Hoiberg was a coach, they'd be 7-4.
Well, so here's my thing about the Boylan thing. Like, even if you want to give them the benefit of the doubt and say, okay, they believe that Jim Boylan is their guy long term going forward, you have to do a coaching search.
Yeah.
Like that's my thing. The Bulls haven't done a coaching search in 10 years at this point. The last time they had a coaching opening and they actually opened the search up and interviewed a bunch of different candidates and actually cast a net and saw what was out there, they ended up hiring Tom Thibodeau and had the most success that they've had under any coach since Phil. When they fired Tibbs, Hoiberg was their guy from day one. Like, that was basically set up a year in advance. They didn't even talk to anybody else. And then this time, they fire Hoiberg midseason. Boylan is the interim for the rest of the season. And then they just sign him to an extension without looking around and seeing what was out there. But, like, to me, you have to go through the process. You have to talk to, like, it wouldn't have been worth talking to Monty Williams. It wouldn't have been worth talking to somebody like Ty Lue, who was out there. Like you have to talk to other guys. And if they ultimately say, okay, we went through the process and we decided Boylan's our guy, okay, fine. At least you went through the process. But you look at what Monty is doing in Phoenix and you see that the Bulls just, you know, committed to Boylan without going through any sort of search. And it's not looking great at this point.
Well, you kind of touched on why. I don't have a problem with them not even doing the search, but if you're going to go in that direction, man, you better be right with Jim Boylan.
Well, but they better have been right with Fred Hoiberg too. Like they didn't do a coaching search with Hoiberg either. Like they said they were going to. I still remember the press conference when after they fired Tom, Gar and Pax were sitting up there and saying, you know, we're going to go a wide range in coaching search. We're going to leave no stone unturned. And then like 48 hours later, Woj reporting the years and money on Hoiberg's contract. And like it was obvious that it had already like been in the works for a while before that. So
you could quasi justify Hoiberg though. He had success in college. He had success.
It's not even about him as a candidate. It's about not doing your due diligence and talking to other coaches who are out there. Yeah. That's my whole thing is when you have a coaching opening, even if you like 90% know who you want to get, you still have to talk to other people and see what was out there. Monty Williams, they could have had Monty Williams if they wanted him. Phoenix is not exactly have a great reputation as an organization either. I mean, I know the Bulls don't have a great reputation, but like, you know, you know what Phoenix's reputation is right now. And he took that job. Like, he would have taken the Bulls job, I think, if the Bulls had offered him the same contract that Phoenix offered him. Like, I'm not even saying like, oh, Monty Williams should have been their guy the whole time, but you have to talk to him if he's out there. You have to talk to like Ty Lue or Frank Vogel or some of these other guys who are out there. When you have a coaching opening, you don't just like basically say, you know, we really just like what we saw in those 10 games in February that Jim Boylan coached where they looked decent before we shut everybody down. So now we're just going to commit to him without talking to him. Like that's a bad process to me. Like, I would have felt that way even if Boylan ended up working out great and the Bulls were as good as everybody thought they were going to be this season. I still would have felt like, you know, you were doing yourselves a disservice, not doing your due diligence, going through the process of doing a coaching search, even if you basically knew who you were going to hire. That's my whole thing.
Yeah, well, I think you're right. You hit it right on the head. And I will admit, I mean, very few people have been more of a bigger defender of John Paxson than myself. I think he's overall done an incredible job cleaning up Krause's mess and delivering, you know, for the most part, over the last 15 years, good teams, contending teams. But, you know, this situation right here, when you trade Jimmy Butler, a all-NBA player, you better put the rebuild on the fast track. And we're not playing the Sixers game, this joke of going 7 years without an Eastern Conference appearance and calling it a process. That's for mouth breathers. We need to be in the playoffs competing for titles within like 5 years. And you made your bet with this guy, and it's embarrassing right now. It really is with him. I'm not saying it can't be turned around. I would be surprised if it does, frankly. But, you know, I do kind of feel like, I don't know if you feel this way. You can tell, like, people are getting in his ear from the front office. Like, you know, the first game, I pointed this out. He had no timeouts left in the first game of the season in Charlotte. They couldn't advance the ball to half court. It's like the mortal sin in the NBA. You have plenty of timeouts. And you got it with a one-possession game. You can't advance the ball to half court because you wasted all your timeouts. And then the Lakers game happens, and I think somebody had said, hey, Jim, make sure you got one timeout left. And it's like he goes in the opposite direction. Do you think that's happening with Jim Boylan? Because I do. I think after every game or every other game, they're talking to him about, you know, what you need to do and change, and Cornette's out of the rotation now. I think all that stuff's coming from the front office. Or you think I'm just reading?
Jim's a company man. I mean, you see how much he goes out of his way to praise the front office and praise the Reinsdorf.
Oh, it's
He's so, like, I mean, that's the thing about Jim. Like, Jim is a guy who, you know, he's been grinding as an assistant for 20 years, and now he finally gets this opportunity to be a head coach. He's going to do everything he can do to keep it. And so if management tells him, hey, you need to play this guy, yes, sir, yeah, I'm going to do it. Like, that's kind of like he now finally, after 20 years, has an opportunity to be a head coach. So he's going to do whatever he has to do to make his bosses happy so that he gets to stay a head coach. That's the sense I kind of get with him right now.
Yeah, agreed. Sean, you're the best, brother. I got hit the ground running here, but man, I can't thank you enough for jumping on. Thank you so much.
Always good to talk to you.